believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Junction City, Kansas, and became a broadcast journalist. He was the local anchor for the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. For the last 13 years, he's been our eyes and ears for the news each night on WDIV, and he's won 12 Emmys. He's also a best-selling author of children's books, a musician, and a singer-songwriter. His name, Mr. Flashpoint, Devin Skillian. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's Jack.
We're with Mr. Flashpoint, Devin Skillian. Devin, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you, Jack, for the invitation.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Sure. I grew up all over the place. The most complicated question anybody can ask me is, where are you from? Because my dad was a career military officer. And by the time I was 18, I think we'd moved about a dozen times. So born at Fort Riley, Kansas, and then we moved to Nebraska, then we moved back to Kansas, and my brother was born. And then we moved to Indiana, and then Maryland, then Virginia, then the Philippines, then Kentucky, then Georgia, then Washington, D.C. You know, I forgot Germany in there somewhere. Pennsylvania. We moved all over the place. And I think to a lot of people, that seems like a very strange upbringing. To my brother Troy and I don't imagine we could figure out how else it could have been or should have been. We got to see a lot of the country that way, got to see a lot of the world, and grew up in the Vietnam era, so my dad did 3 tours of duty in Vietnam, and will forever be a hero of mine for a lot of reasons, but that's not the least among them, certainly. Both my parents were the first people in their respective families to ever go to college. So my mom, Betty Skillian, is from Evansville, Indiana. My dad, from Western Kentucky, Bill Skillian. And here I come many years later.
What were the biggest things you learned from your mom and your dad?
My mom really, I think, gave me a great, whatever artistic sense I have. My mom enjoyed painting. She loved music. She was very much into theater. In fact, she was doing a lot of community theater. As I was, she would take me in my little, my little crib, and she would be doing, or at my little car seat, she would be doing, performing on stage while I'd be sitting there as a baby in the audience. And so I think that gave me my real, that smell of backstage and theaters and all that, which I would later pursue when I first got to college. And she got me, she was very into music. My dad, taught me a lot about, honor and, duty, responsibility, and tenacity. My dad is, a terrific golfer. My dad turned 72, this past year and, went out and shot 66. So, and you only get to do that by, having a serious tenacity about the game. So I couldn't imagine better parents. They live in the Dallas area, and it's one of the toughest things about being in Detroit is that I'm a long way away from them, and my brother who lives in the Dallas area with his family, too.
How did you ever break into broadcasting, Devin?
It's a strange thing because I it wasn't anything really that was particularly on my radar. I went to the University of Kansas on a theater scholarship, partial theater scholarship, and was really planning on studying theater. And one day, I was starting to get interested in doing some radio things I took a television news class, and I was getting a little interested in it. But one day I was in the green room at the theater department, and they came over and they posted an audition for they were going to start a new campus news program, and they needed the anchor people for it. And I thought, I bet I can act like an anchorman. It's just another acting job. And I had completely misread the whole thing because I show up and every journalism student on campus is there, and they've been studying the scripts for a couple of days. And I thought, uh-oh, this is a little more serious than I thought. But I ended up getting that. And little by little, really started to fall in love with the storytelling portion of journalism, writing, the fact that you kind of get to write the first draft of history. I loved the pressure of it, because which is one of the things that I liked about theater. But with television and news, the script changed every day. I liked that a lot. And I think one of the most intoxicating things that happened to me, I was working one morning a shift at the campus radio station in 1983, a little underground rock station. Did I have 12 people even listening that morning? And on the little television that we used to get the weather reports each morning, they had broken in to say that there had been a bombing at the American barracks in Beirut, and that a bunch of American servicemen had been killed. Now, I don't know what possessed me to think that my 12 people listening to KJCK at my underground rock station, or KJHK, were needing this information, but I thought, I've got to tell people what's going on. I actually have a tape of it still at home, and my voice was so shaky, and I was, you know, there's been a bombing, and you know that. But by the end of the morning, I was waxing about the multinational forces that had been stationed in Lebanon and going on and on, and I really liked the energy and the adrenaline and the importance of feeling like I had this piece of information that people had to know.
Speaking of what you mentioned, the first draft of history, let's go back to April 19, 1995, 9:03 a.m.
Yeah. Well, we were living in Oklahoma City, out in an area in the northwest part of town, which is known as the Putnam City area in Oklahoma City. We were probably 12 to 13 miles from downtown Oklahoma City, and it shook my house. We heard it. I was just kind of lounging around in bed. My wife, Corey, went running outside because we were sure whatever it was, it had to be in the neighborhood. And other people were coming out, too. We thought maybe it was a gas well explosion, something like that. There was an oil well or two in the area. It could have been that, but couldn't see anything. Had no idea what it was. Well, it didn't take too much longer before phone rang and I needed to get to work. I was the anchor at the time at KFOR, the NBC affiliate in Oklahoma City. And, you know, the horrible things that unfolded there over the next, I think my stint on the air that day was about 14 hours, was the saddest, worst day of my life.
When we come back, we'll ask Devin Scillian the biggest lesson he learned that day. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us and News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR, brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Once again, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with Devin Scillian. For the last 13 years, he's been our eyes and ears for the news on DIV each night. Devin, April 19th, 1995, Oklahoma City bombing. Yeah. What's the biggest lesson you walked away from?
You know, it took me a long time, I think, to completely process it all. You can go to Oklahoma City and walk through the amazing memorial and museum there, and I think it gives you a sense of how difficult it was for all of us. It was such a complicated experience. But I think, looking back at it now, I've come to understand that I had started to reach that point in my journalist career where I had started to develop that crusty cynicism that reporters tend to develop. I had been to enough places in the world and in the United States, not just around the world, but you know, even locally, where I'd seen some, you know, enough horrible things. I'd been to the Mideast where hatred just seems in the stones. I'd been to Haiti, the poorest country in the whole world, watching kids the ages of my kids at home playing in raw sewage in the streets. I'd been to Siberia in the first winter of democracy, where it was so cold and people had so little. And I'd covered things like the gang problem in Los Angeles, where kids were getting shot for having the wrong color of baseball hat on. And I had started to think, you know, that we were getting to that point where life was not getting better, that things were pretty bad. And it's quite an irony to me that the worst day of my life really changed my mind about that. Oklahoma City restored my optimism. Odd thing to say, because that day there was so much palpable sadness in the air. And It was so frustrating waiting for to try it. We were just lost trying to get a handle on exactly what had happened and how big this was, how many people were in there. And there was that moment at about 10:30 when somebody said, isn't there a daycare center in the Murrah building? And it just kept getting, you know, worse and worse. And at about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon, we were doing a live report because we were just obviously on all the time. And we went down to a reporter named Anthony Foster who was standing outside the triage area. And we hadn't, nobody had come out to tell us what was going on. We weren't getting, you know, they had so much, their hands were so full, they really didn't have a whole lot of time to tell the media what was going on. And finally, two nurses came out of the triage center. And Anthony went rushing up to them, and this was on live television. And he said to the one, "Where are you going?" And she said, "Home. They're sending us home." And he said, "Why?" And she said, "Because there's no one to save." And the despair that set in on the—I mean, we just thought we might all be crushed by the sadness of that moment. Because it's in human nature that we would be waiting for some optimism, something to cling to. We had seen building collapses over the years before in places like Korea and Mexico. And a week later, they're pulling people out of the rubble who've survived on rainwater. Weren't we going to get any of that? Well, no. Because in those instances, you had a building collapse on top of people. At the Murrah building, you had a building explode first, and then it collapsed. Well, the explosion first in on the building from the truck out front. And so where in the world were we going to find our, you know, our glimmers of hope? We didn't think there were any. We didn't think. And then we started to watch what was happening. Slowly, little by little, the miracle that was occurring in front of us was starting to reveal itself. We went on the air and we said, if you'd like to donate blood, here's where you need to go. Well, 20 minutes later, we had to go on and say, look, there is a 3-mile line of cars backing up to the blood bank. They're asking if you can come back tomorrow. But if you would like to help, they would like some, they're in need of blankets down at the bombing site. 20 minutes later, we'd have to go on the air and say, they now have so many blankets, they don't quite know what to do with them all. So no more blankets, but they could use gloves. Half an hour later, they would be inundated with gloves. Need after need, so many people who felt they didn't know what they could do. They just knew that they had to do something. And so when we offered up an opportunity, people were grasping it. And we started to slowly realize that it was people all over the country who were doing whatever they could. My favorite story about the Oklahoma City bombing. This woman called me a few days later to tell me that we had gone on the air and we said that they, because of the rescue dogs, they needed more dog shoes. Now, when we say dog shoes for rescue dogs, these are not the little knitted crocheted booties that you see on poodles in the wintertime. These are work shoes for dogs, and they're basically akin to sled dog shoes. Well, not something that you carry a whole lot in Oklahoma City sporting goods stores. So this woman decided when we said they needed more dog shoes, that was going to be her thing. She called a sporting goods store in Anchorage, Alaska. Said, I need all the dog shoes that you have. And he said, what are you talking about? And she said, well, I'm calling from Oklahoma City. And the guy said, Oklahoma City, we've been watching all day. What can I do for you? She explained the situation. He said, look, I've got a gross of them back here. You can have them if you can just get them to Oklahoma City. She said, I'll call you back. She calls an airline, I believe it was Alaska Airlines, and explains, I need some dog shoes picked up from... And the guy says, lady, what are you talking about? And she says, well, I'm calling from Oklahoma City. And the guy said, Oklahoma City, we've been watching you all day. What can I do for you? She explained. He said, I'll tell you what, we don't fly to Oklahoma City. We fly to Denver. I will send a courier over to the sporting goods shop. He'll pick up the dog shoes. He'll bring them all the way over. He'll bring them to the airport. We'll get them on a plane. We'll get them to Denver if you can get them from there. She said, I'll call you back. She calls the next airline. I think it was United. Same exact situation. The guy says, Oklahoma City, what can I do for you? She explains. He says, well, that's not really our terminal, but I'll tell you what, I'll send a courier over to the Alaska Airlines terminal. He'll pick them up. He'll put them at the top. You just be there to pick them up at Will Rogers World Airport in Oklahoma City. I mean, amazing what she had pulled together. She goes down to the airport. Sure enough, here comes this huge box of dog shoes off the conveyor belt. She puts them in the back of her minivan. She drives down to the bombing site. And wouldn't you know it, she got down there. They had to explain that somebody else had already figured out a way to get a lot of dog shoes. They didn't need all the shoes that she had gotten in. That's my favorite story, not because of the irony or the, you know, the funny fact that somebody had already beat her to it, but how much she had tried and believed she had to do something, and how many other people she came in contact who believed they had to do something. So the lesson, Jack, to get back to the question you asked me a long time ago, what did I learn from the Oklahoma City bombing? For every one or two truly evil people in the world, there are millions of good people ready to drop everything at a moment's notice to try and help somebody they don't ever know, they don't even know. And those are odds we can all live with.
Outsiders come to Detroit, Devin Scillian, and they see opportunities. They have hope. They want to make things happen. We here see hurdles, obstacles, impediments.
Yeah.
How do we change our thinking?
You know, it's a tough one. I think by nature, most people coming into a new situation, doesn't have to be Detroit, when you're moving to, whether it's Paris or Newark, New Jersey, when you're going into something new, I think you've got a certain amount of optimism. By nature, I think that's sort of how the way we are. And then when you're there somewhere, whether it's Newark, New Jersey, or Paris, you think, this place isn't, you know, it's got all of its problems. You start to focus on those things. But you're absolutely right. We have been unable to change the rest of the world's thinking about Detroit, largely, I believe, because we haven't quite changed our own. We say we have, but we really haven't. And we have got to develop a sense of optimism about ourselves before we ever start worrying about anybody else. If this becomes a city that we can live with, then I have no doubt that we can sell it to other people.
As we go to a break, Devin Scillian,
mm-hmm.
would you lead us in a little portion of one of the many songs you've written?
Sure. This is from my A is for America album, which is a children's album, and this is called Americana. Cornflakes and birthday cakes, fireworks and chocolate shakes, hot dogs and roller skates, and good old Uncle Sam. Mickey Mouse and soda pop, Rocky Road and Rocky Top, swimming hole belly flop, and green eggs and ham. From New York to L.A., from St. Paul to Santa Fe, how many things would you say make Americana?
Devin Scillian, Americana. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Presented by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with Devin Scillian, who's written 10 children's books. A is for America is the national bestseller throughout all the schools. Devin, you're a news anchor, journalist. You're a husband, dad, man of faith, author, musician, singer, songwriter. How do you do it all?
You know, when you read it like that, I don't know. That makes me exhausted. You know, my wife and I laugh about, you know, am I multi-talented or do I just lack focus? It could be that I just lack focus. You know, it's funny. I think part of it is that, for starters, I don't sleep a whole lot. I write a lot. Very late at night when I get home. I just, I can get by on 5 or 6 hours of sleep a night pretty easily. So I think the bigger part of it is the things that I like to do are, you know, these would be my hobbies, whether or not they were showing up in bookstores and record stores. You know what I mean? I mean, I would be playing the guitar and writing music anyway. It sounds like it's a whole other career, but it's just, you know, I mean, from the time of my, you know, we've had this long running routine when my kids were little, when they were in the bathtub, I was, you know, sitting next to them with the guitar and just kind of, you know, writing songs usually about whatever it was they were doing in the bathtub at the time. So the other thing though that I've had to admit to myself over the years is some of this stuff must just come pretty easily to me, and I'm fairly lucky that way. I find writing to be a really enjoyable. I know for some writers it's really angst ridden and just murder. It's not that way for me.
By your own admission, you're an American storyteller. We had Mitch Albom on the show a few years ago.
Sure.
And I said, how do you do it all? And he said, Jack, I only do one thing. I tell stories.
I could not agree more. When the one thing, it looks like I'm very scattershot to say, to look at all these different things. You just read the list you just read. But, you know, journalist, author, songwriter, they're all telling stories. That's really what, I think Mitch is right on the money. That's what he does, and that's what I do. You know, as an author, when you're Mitch Albom or me or any of the other writers, you know, you get our sort of creative freedom, artistic license to make up your own stuff. And then as a journalist, you're trying to find a compelling way to tell stories that are true. But I think that's the, I'm fascinated by stories.
Many of your guests on Flashpoint, they're storytellers too.
Oh, right? Isn't that the truth? Sometimes my job is to figure out which part of their story is a story and which part's the truth, right?
When you ask these people a question and they talk and they never give you the answer, yeah, and you ask again, how do you not get frustrated and just say, give me the answer?
I do get frustrated. But, you know, I also, it's not my job. It's my job to ask the question. It's my job to try and get an answer. Very skilled, you know, of course, politicians have always learned that you don't necessarily answer the question you're being asked. You answer the question that you want to answer, that you have an answer for. So it's a little bit of a joust each time. But by and large, people are responsible for their own, people who are on Flashpoint, if they don't answer a question, if I've asked it twice, then I think it's on them that they haven't answered the question. Not necessarily. I mean, I'm doing what I can, but I think people are fairly transparent. People get it. People can see through the veneer of whether when somebody tries to slickly avoid answering a question. People get it.
As a follow up to that, what made Tim Russert so great?
For me, it was a lot of different things, and I was fortunate enough to get to know Tim a little bit and spend a little bit of time with him. But I think the biggest thing for me, and this is one of the things that is dangerously in jeopardy right now in journalism, Tim staunchly fought for his neutrality. There was no give-in from him to say, as some things that pass now for news shows on cable news channels are really just commentary disguised as news analysis. You know, good luck really figuring out where Tim was on most issues, because Tim was tenacious with everybody, the people he agreed with and the people he didn't agree with. And I've always believed that that was my job on Flashpoint. And Tim has helped me over the years really realize that, you know, our job as a journalist is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, and challenge everybody when it comes time for, you know, when you're even people that you may agree with politically, or you've got to challenge them, force them to defend their position as well. And Tim was tenacious with everybody, and yet he never lost his connection to the everyday people in America. And that's a big thing right now, because we're seeing America's turning into a smile. It's the West Coast and the East Coast, and the middle of the country is being left behind sometimes.
Speaking of which, what one person that you've interviewed has left the biggest impression on you, Devin Scillian?
I would have to probably Ben Carson. Dr. Ben Carson, a Detroit native who went from being a kid who was called stupid in school, had a terrible problem with his temper, all kinds of crazy issues growing up as a child in Detroit. There was the day that he and his brother and his mom found out that their dad had a whole other family on the other side of town. I mean, a million different obstacles that were down in front of Ben's way. And Ben is now today one of the leading pediatric neurosurgeons in the world at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. He's an amazingly inspiring guy to me.
Yes. Dyslexic. His mom raised him.
Yeah.
Phenomenal
yeah.
story.
Really is.
What one person do you want to have on Flashpoint?
Well, you know, it's a very long list. I have always been fascinated by the papacy. I would love to have the Pope on. That would be great. Terribly sorry that I never got to interview his predecessor. I think right now I'd love to interview most of the people who are sort of those mysterious figures right now that are moving our world in so many different directions. Have your pick: Kim Jong Il, if he's still around, Hugo Chavez, Osama bin Laden, Vladimir Putin, There's just the world is full of people who are making huge decisions impacting many, many people. And I'm always fascinated by the motivations, the personal philosophies, all the things behind those people.
Well, Detroit is not in favor with the rest of the country right now.
Yep.
If you were on Meet the Press and you had a couple minutes, what would you tell America about Detroit?
Well, one of the things that's really frustrated me as we watched all of that, the hearings, the big three going before Congress and watching, you know, David Cole has a great line about everybody in America. Nobody would think that they were a nuclear physicist or nuclear physics expert, but everybody in America thinks they're an automobile expert because they own one. And the lack of understanding about how the way the automobile industry works and the way that its tentacles reach into all of Detroit and the whole country, it completely confounds me. I don't even have to talk about it just in Detroit, but my hometown of Junction City, Kansas, has one auto dealer in it. General Motors dealer. General Motors collapses. That one auto dealer, he's the biggest advertiser on the local newspaper, biggest advertiser at the local radio station. He's the guy that really supports the high school sports programs. What happens if you lose that? That's why the auto industry is different than almost every other industry in America, and that's really what makes Detroit different from many other cities. But I was feeling in the middle of those hearings, man, we're in the Superdome. There's a hurricane blowing outside, and nobody's coming to get us. Nobody's even listening. Frustrating.
Now, you've done country western.
Yes.
If you played a country western, this song would be Too Long in the Tooth. But this is Too Long in the Rain.
This is from my Tulsa album. We saw it once, maybe twice, a glimpse of something nice. We keep trying, baby, to get it right. But I'm not sure it's worth the strain. It's too long in the rain. Now I know it's a fact that opposites attract. But I wouldn't change it, baby. Take things back. 'Cause nothing ventured, nothing gained, but it's too long in the rain.
Devin Skillian, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm, presents Anything Is Possible with Jack Crisula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Devin Skillian, a local treasure.
How nice.
That's what Corey calls you every morning, a local
yes,
treasure.
Yes, sir.
Go to work. Devin, how can we learn about the children's books, about the music?
There's probably more than anybody would ever need to know about me at devinskillian.com. So there's, in fact, I get a cavity looking at the website, so no, but that'll help. You can find links there to buy everything, you know.
In 2007, you did a documentary on the American manufacturing crisis. It was entitled The China Syndrome.
Right.
What were the biggest things you learned on that China trip?
Well, I came to realize that, you know, manufacturing is a little bit like a mistress. She is always going to leave you for a better deal. Manufacturing is a really difficult piece to hold on to. Now, America has got to hang on to some kind of manufacturing capacity. I think we've all come to agree on that. But some of the more, you know, low-level, easy manufacturing is just too easy to export. I was in a plant where they make brass fittings, and they were being made on machines that had come out of Grand Haven, Michigan. The exact same machines. They had picked up the machines, moved them out of the plant, moved them to Zhongshan, China. Now, keep in mind, this is brass. They were taking brass, shipping it all the way to China to have it machined into these parts and then shipped back. And yet it was somehow cheaper to do that with heavy brass than it was to just make them in Grand Haven. Now, we can argue and fight all we want, but just go look at your house and look at how many different things in your house are products of the global economy. Well, it works that way in the business world, too, just like it does in your house. They're shopping at Walmart. They're looking for a way to cut costs as well. So what I came to realize, the most important thing to me that I learned about the global economy, there's three pieces of any business, Jack, as you know. There's innovation and design, there's manufacturing, and there's distribution. The middle part is the mistress. It's just China today. It's becoming Vietnam. It's becoming South America. It's going to be Africa. There's always going to be a cheaper place to make your stuff. What America has to do is we have to continue to own the first and third part of the deal. We have got to remain the culture of innovation. One thing that I did not see in China or that I haven't seen anywhere in my world travels, America is still the only place where two guys can go in their garage and build an iPod. or whatever. We still have this innovative dream culture that is terribly important. We've got to nurture that like mad. And then we have to be, you know, the distributors. We've got to own the product at the other end.
I recall in that show there was a business owner who was fighting with his employees because
because they wanted to be allowed to work 7 days a week. He was forcing them to take off Sundays. In fact, he had a problem just hanging up, keeping them to 8 hours a day. They wanted to work 12 hours, but he had decided after his years of business that after 8 hours, your productivity drops off terribly in this kind of manufacturing that they do, and it wasn't worth it to have them work. He couldn't let them work more than 8 hours. But he was having a real problem. Now, since I left there, things have changed in China. Wages are creeping up. They're getting, you know, developing their workers demanding more rights just the way that we did. So much of what's going on in China is a mirror of our own industrial revolution. They're just a little bit behind it. You know, they're years behind it. But remember, Jack, when you and I were growing up, there was a lot of stuff in your house that said made in Hong Kong. Remember? Well, nothing now is made in Hong Kong. Same thing. Hong Kong's become the banking, the commerce center of Asia. The stuff is made on the other side of the water in China, on mainland China.
That documentary won you the Edward R. Murrow Award, one of the highest honors in all of journalism.
We're really proud of it. Really proud. Tim Pamplin was the photographer. Vanessa Ogletree was the editor on it, and couldn't have been. It is one of those nice. There's a lot of, you know, Emmys are nice and things like that, but the Edward R. Murrow Award kind of stands on its own ground.
You've authored 10 books,
yeah.
Children's books. Why children's books?
You know, that's just, I don't know. That is something that has fascinated me forever. Loved books, obviously, when I was very young. But even when I wrote my first children's story when I was in high school. And then studied children's literature a bit in college. And have just always had a fascination with it. I just love the way that your imagination is given such license to go wherever you want it to, and kids go with you. There's no reluctance like there is maybe when we get older to really take a flight of fancy. And so I've just always had I love watching what books do to kids when you watch the way that they, you know, they don't have as many filters. They love it like it's a piece of, you know, if it's a book they really like, really love, they love it like it's a piece of, you know, piece of candy. It's a great thing to watch to me.
You're classy. You're upbeat. You're not sarcastic. You're in a business that breeds that.
Can be.
What
yes.
do you drink?
You know, I don't know I do think what happened in Oklahoma City, you know, really got rid of some of the cynicism in me. But I have great respect for what I do, and I know that a lot of people like to deride television news, journalism overall. People see in a very strange light, I think, sometimes. But you know, we have got to get to a place where we're at a point where we're going to start losing a lot of newspapers in this country, which is a really bad thing. I mean, we can say, yes, it's all going to the web. Well, who do you think is going to do stories like coming up with all those text messages back in January, a year ago, that ML Elric and Jim Schaefer uncovered at the Free Press? Nobody's going to be able to do those kind of stories if we don't support some mainstream media. And, you know, you can say, people say, well, journalism is a business. It is a business. There's no doubt about it. But there's a reason why journalism is mentioned in the American Constitution. It is a terribly important part of a functioning democracy, and I have a great respect for it.
Can you tell us what your normal day is?
Do I have those? you know, I work, I guess, the equivalent of the second shift at an auto plant. I go to work about 2:30 or so in the afternoon, and get ready, do those early newscasts. Then we start all over again, and we do the late newscasts, and I usually get home a little bit after midnight. But, you know, early part of my day is if I'm not writing, then Corey and I are taking dance lessons as we did recently for the Detroit Historical Society, and, you know, just do all those regular kinds of things. It's pretty normal at my house, really.
Then you come to work and you dance with Bernie Smilovitz, huh?
As long as he lets me lead, we're fine.
Last question.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to our young listeners as we start a new year?
You know, I think that one of the things that's really important when you're young is realizing that, you know, life is a little bit like a cafeteria. And if you go through the cafeteria every day picking the same thing, man, shame on you. There is so much in our world to taste, to enjoy, to see, to hear, to feel. And I think that especially when you're young, your life really ought to be about discovering your passions. Your vocations will come. Those are fine. But nobody lays on their deathbed and says, gosh, I just wish I would have worked harder. Your life really ends up being about your passions, and that involves your family and the things that you really love to do. And I think the earlier that you find those passions, for me, it's things like music, but that's just me. For other people, it's something else. But finding those passions, I think, is really what the key to life is all about.
Devin, thanks for what you do, but more importantly, how you do it. You're an inspiration to every one of us every night.
I appreciate that very much, Jack. Thanks.
Please join us next week. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Make it a great 2009, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom.